Bonjour tout le monde. Hey everyone. Today I am joined by Benjamin Dichter, Honking for Freedom. The name is BJ, right? There you go. You came out with a book. You've been so busy since the last time we talked. That was 2 years ago. So most of people have known you in the past years because of the Freedom Convoy. You were one of the spokesperson. I've seen you even on Tucker Carlson. So you were pretty busy 2 years ago. I think you're still a busy man. Do you want to just give a heads up for those who don't know who you are? Who are you? You're a trucker. That I know, but there's so much to know. Who are you?
Yeah, I mean, people know me because I was the spokesperson and kind of the media strategist during the Freedom Convoy itself. Done a lot of things. I'm a kind of serial entrepreneur, I guess you might say. Had many careers, and most recently bought a truck during COVID to get away from the nonsense, which is how I got into this. But at one point, I was involved politically. I ran for the Conservatives federally. But yeah, that's a good way to describe who I am. Just general.
You were involved politically before the pandemic, right?
Yes. In 2015, I ran in the federal election. Had a taste of politics from the inside, realized, yeah, I like people who are a little bit more honest, and I backed away from the political establishment.
That proves my point. I am not into politics. I don't really believe in politicians anymore. Anyways, but that's another story. I'd like you to tell us. So it's been 2 years. We're almost in March now. So 2 years ago, we were in a very different place in Canada. I don't feel like it has changed that much, but it's more subtle, I guess. But I'd like you to tell us, so how did the convoy got organized, and how did you get involved with it?
So basically, and I write about this in the book, honkingforfreedom.com, by the way, to get your copy.
Cool.
I was called by Tamara Leach in the middle of January. I believe it was January 15th. It's a couple of years, so I'm starting to forget things. But I believe it was around January 15th. I had met her, quite a few years before. We had formed a friendship, and she said, yeah, my friends and I have started a convoy and need somebody who can do communications and do press releases, that sort of thing. Somebody knows the media traps. And this is what we're upset about. And I said, yeah, I'm completely on board. I'd love to help. And sure, I got no problem helping with communications and putting together a strategy for that. And I said to her in that first conversation, I said, but I remember there was a convoy in 2019 that was co-opted, that she was part of. And I said, but you got to make me one deal. We're not there for any political parties. We're not there for any politicians. Where they're just to get rid of the mandates and get rid of the arrive cans so we can get back to normal life. Mm-hmm. And she said, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I said, okay, great. I'm on board.
So the convoy was already sort of organized when you jumped in.
Yes. It turns out what she didn't tell me is there were, I think, 11 truckers who already had started this movement.
Okay.
Out west, Ontario and out west. And she then got involved, and so when she said, me and my friends started this convoy, I don't know if that's the best way to describe it, but whatever. So she got involved afterwards, which I believe is also what happened in 2019.
And okay, so we need to remember at this moment, the people who were refusing to get vaxxed were living a lot of, it was almost violence. Some people were losing their jobs. They couldn't travel anymore. Our leaders, so-called leaders, were very, very cruel in the words they would use to describe us. So when this convoy happened, I really remember feeling just very, very burning hope in my chest. Like it felt, oh, at last, it's happening. Something is happening. We needed this, I guess, this breath of fresh air. And when did you start thinking, oh my God, like this is historical, like we're assisting to something really important?
I can't say that I actually ever entered that frame just because I was so busy. For me, it was work. It was just constantly, It was a constant grind dealing with issues. How are you going to message? I got to get a word out. I called every favor I could from any person I knew who had a large platform or knew people with a large platform to try to get the word out there. And I knew that legacy media would not be honest in its coverage of the convoy. I produce podcasts. I had been producing podcasts for a few years, so I know the alternative media space. I knew a lot of people. And I thought this is going to be the opportunity for more independent creators like yourself, to tell the truth of what was going on in Ottawa. So that was my focus. I wasn't really focused on, is this historical? Or there was just no time.
Right. So you were a trucker. So you were aware that some people in the country were feeling smothered. But did you think at that moment that this might actually save lives of people who were, you know, thinking about committing suicide? Or was the suffering of the people, was it in the back of your head somehow?
I know people were distraught, and I think the creeping authoritarianism that became very evident had a severe impact on mental anguish amongst Canadians. Yeah. I really didn't realize the degree, because I'm pretty good with stress. There's not much that stresses me out, but I'm sensitive to the fact that other people do. Yeah. And it wasn't until after we were in Ottawa, I received, I think we talked about this once before, these two messages through social media, through DMs, both women out west, different parts of the country, different provinces, same story. They both had two kids. They lost their jobs. They're running out of money. They're going to be homeless. And they thought about committing suicide. And the only thing that prevented them from doing that was the fact that they both had young children, and they couldn't figure out what to do with their young children. And then they saw the clips online of the trucks driving across the country, and they realized, wow, I'm actually not alone. There's other people who feel the same way. So that's when it really hit me.
And that is so important, because I did receive a lot of messages like that. Course, just like you, I was already speaking out, so being sort of a public figure, being against the mandates at that moment, and not a lot of people were doing so. So I had a lot of people, you know, contacting me, telling me how isolated they felt, and depressed, and their family wouldn't talk to them anymore, their friends. I could really feel very sorry for them. I was lucky enough, the fact that I was speaking out, I had a lot of people who were reaching out to me, being on my side, you know, so I didn't feel alone, never, because I was, you know, very outspoken about what was going on. But I can only imagine how isolated those people felt, and how important it was to see, you know, those videos where there were so many people rushing to Ottawa. It was so important. And now looking back, so there has been a lot, you know, a lot of craziness. So your bank account was frozen. You've been through a lot. Would you say that the convoy sort of did what it was meant to be? Did it hit the goals?
Yeah, I think so. You saw during the convoy, the provincial leaders, who, by the way, were equally authoritarian, and it doesn't matter if they're conservative or liberal, they all did the same thing. But during the convoy, when we saw, in particular, Doug Ford, because the protest was in Ontario, started message testing. You know, one day he would say he supported the truckers. The next day he said he didn't. Then the next day he went back. I knew, okay, they're message testing. They're getting some data telling them there's a lot of support for this. And subsequently, what did we see? We saw that the provinces all dropped their mandate requirements. Of course, they tried to give themselves enough of a buffer, you know, a week, a couple of weeks, depending which province. In the case of BC, I think it was until April. So they could say hashtag nothing to do with truckers. And then the federal government did it, 6 or 8 months after, did the same thing. Nothing to do with truckers. But they all knew. They knew that I knew that they knew that it was because of the convoy that they were forced to drop it.
Of course, I think just like you on this, but I would say a lot of people don't. Like the majority of people who watch the news don't see any connection. So how do we How do we get the public opinion to change its perception of what happened? Do you think it's ever going to happen?
So I think it depends on where you are. So if you're in a city, then you're going to see people who are more pushing back against the convoy. And if you're in rural communities, the vast majority of the people there see the trucker convoy as a bunch of heroes that made us free. Yeah. What's interesting is the only people in the world, and I think you know, I've now been spoken in El Salvador, in the United Kingdom, been all over the U.S. The only people who can't get it through their heads are Canadians.
Right.
It's wild. It's absolutely wild. And maybe that's because of the state of how our media operates.
Yeah.
I do like the frame that Scott, who I've gotten to know a little bit, Scott Adams, the frame that he puts on this, which is there's two movies, one screen. And depending what media you have access to, that's going to prime you to have a certain set of predispositions and opinions. And that's how you're going to look at the world. So, I mean, I saw this when I was in politics. It's already started back then. Based on the opinion somebody would regurgitate back to me, I could tell what media they're exposed to and what they're watching. And I think I've spent the past year, I actually just had a phone call with somebody from the UK who is a liberal, trying to reach out to people on the other side, because enough time has passed. It's no longer the craziness of, you know, we're in the middle of convoy. People have gotten back to their regular lives, where I'm now speaking to more and more people who are on the opposite end of COVID or opinions on COVID or on the political spectrum, who are now at least willing to listen. And a perfect example, I had a friend of mine, you know, we all lost friends during COVID, those of us who wanted to speak up. And I had a friend of mine, me and her lost touch. She works in public health and she just didn't understand any opposition to it. She just bought into the entire government narrative. Okay. And she finally reached out to me 3 months ago and say, hey, you know, I was just thinking about you, how you been, whatever. And we reconnected, we got together. She didn't know I wrote a book. So I gave her the book and she said to me, oh my God, I can't believe everything I was told. I mean, not everything, but most of what I was told was completely fabricated. I said, yes, that's why it's important. And I tell my conservative friends, you need to listen to people on the left. You need to understand how they come to their ideas, and people on the left need to understand people on the other side. Because if not, if we remain in these silos, this bifurcation of our society is just going to get worse. And that's what I was trying to fix or try to help fix during the convoy. I had so many conversations with liberals. There were 33, I think it was 33, liberal MPs that were forming a coalition within Blackface's party and his caucus that were trying to put together a confidence vote to get rid of him. Because most of us are kind of in agreement that we don't want society to collapse. And most of us are not on board with the extremism. And I saw the kernels of that starting during the convoy. That's why I spent so much time trying to reach people on both sides. But, you know, the political class didn't like that. That's why they had to put an end to the podcast, an end to the protest.
Yeah, and they did in a very brutal way. So I did remember, because I was there every week to cover what was going on without the mainstream media glasses. And I did remember, like, there was this moment where it just it switched. Like, it was not the Woodstock vibe anymore. It became ominous, and we felt threatened just to be there, and not by the truckers, but, you know, the police had a different attitude. They had police coming from all over the country. They were not even the police from Ottawa. So was there a moment when you were there, when you started feeling a little worried about what could happen to you?
No, I wasn't concerned about myself. I was too busy with, we got to make sure everybody is safe. Everybody remains peaceful and positive and whatever. I'll be fine.
So you were never scared that you might end up in jail?
No, the only time that, and this might have been a misjudgment on my case, which was on February 19th, when I left the hotel and went to stay with a friend of mine in Ottawa for another month. I got a call from one of the lawyers, Keith Wilson, who I don't know that he had our best interests at heart. This might have been good legal advice. He called me that morning when the police started cracking down, and he said, you need to leave the hotel. I said, what do you mean I have to leave the hotel? Why? I got a broken leg. I'm in a wheelchair.
Yeah, because you did break your ankle during the convoy.
Yeah. And he said, well, Tamara's been arrested. Somebody else has been arrested. And I'm like, okay, but they're out on the street. I'm a guy in a wheelchair. What do you think, you're gonna break down the doors of the Sheraton and drag out a guy of a wheelchair? He's like, well, they might. I'm like, no, I don't think so. And for 20 minutes, he wouldn't stop. You got to leave. And I had people around me telling, and I finally acquiesced and said, okay, I'll try to leave. I don't know if you can get an Uber, but if I can get an Uber, I'll go see my friend a couple of days early. Fine. There were some people around me, Daniel Borman and Salman Seema, who said to me, don't leave. It's a setup. I'm like, maybe, but he's technically our board's lawyer. People have been, you know, I want to de-escalate things if this is what's going to help. It might be a setup. It might not be. I don't know. I'll see if I can get an Uber. If I can, I'll go. And they're like, don't. I'm like, you know what? I agree with you, but let's just see what happens. As soon as I got into the Uber and started driving away from downtown, there was a tweet from Keith Wilson's very close friend, Ezra Levant from Rebel News, saying, it looks like you ran away. And wow. Then a whole bunch of people attacking me like, oh, yeah. So it was a setup.
It was a setup. Yeah. Okay. Let's get into that. So I had a discussion last week with a podcaster in Quebec. He wanted me to debate him the concept of controlled opposition.
Okay.
So I'm not a big, like, I don't really believe, I know it exists, but like, I feel like so many people are just, they will say everything is controlled, whether it's me or Tucker Carlson, you know, everybody's bad basically. So I don't really like this concept. And that brings me to the Freedom Convoy. A lot of people said that it was hijacked by controlled opposition, that there was some people who were not pretending actually that they were there for the convoy, but they weren't. What do you think about this whole concept?
Well, it wasn't co-opted by controlled opposition. It was co-opted by the political establishment directly. Mm. Like, but pretty simple. And, you know, you could see they even... If you look at the POEC testimony, we have email communications between Candace Bergen and Justin Trudeau. She was the interim leader for the Conservative Party when Erin O'Toole resigned.
Okay.
Email communications with the two of them saying, we agree, we have to put an end to the protest. And Candace says, hey, can we get on the phone? And then the rest of it is redacted. So they were clearly trying to end. And I knew something was going on. During the protests as well. I don't know that if I call that controlled opposition. I'd say that's direct political interference, because in 3 weeks, you know, the framing is this: Justin Trudeau, it took Jerry 4 years to raise $40 million to get Trudeau elected prime minister. We raised cumulatively almost $24 million in 3 weeks. You know why? Because we were the official opposition. And that's what they were worried about, because people are not going along with the fake bifurcated, you know, structure of our political class, and they had to put an end to it.
So it was basically a vote we were giving you by giving you money.
Those dollars were votes. And it seems to be what happened was there's a bunch of truckers that wanted to have the protest. They were fed up. A bunch of them were going to lose their businesses because they couldn't cross the border anymore. So they started this, they came up with this idea, started the protest. And then shortly after, people who have political ties decided to get involved, and the political establishment, this is my working theory right now, and it's been a couple of years, I've yet to find anything that will disprove it, and I've asked people, but my working theory is they grabbed onto it, they had activists get involved in the protest, to make it a Conservative Party movement, to make it a voting bloc that they could capture, go to Ottawa, get rid of Erin O'Toole, which is whether that was premeditated or not. I know he was not well liked. And a week prior to the convoy, they were already having caucus meetings about getting rid of him. So go to Ottawa, get rid of Erin O'Toole. So February 3rd, Erin O'Toole resigned. February 4th, Candace Bergen, the interim leader now, called us and asked us to have a meeting. And I was in Tamara's room. There was maybe six or seven of us in there. And one of the lawyers, I think it was Tim, came in and said, yeah, good news, Candace Bergen wants to meet with us. And Tamara's, oh, yeah, that's great. Well, I'm going, wait, knowing how they operate. What do you mean she wants to meet with us? Where? Mm-hmm. And they said, the A&W down the street. And I looked at Tamara and I said, no, we're not meeting with her. I said, across the room, I said, you can tell Candace, if she wants to come in and help us, she can come in the back room of this hotel, meet with us, and tell us what she thinks she can do to help. Because if not, we're going to be baited in to doing a photo op where she'll have all of us standing around her like morons as she says, okay, the Conservative Party's here for truckers, but it's time for you to go home. I said, we're not doing that. Mm-hmm. Tell her if that's what she wants. If she wants to meet with us, come and call her and let her know. Then we never heard back from her. And that night, I think it was that night, there was an emergency session of Parliament. She came out to a media scrum. And what did she say?
That he didn't want to talk.
Here for the truckers, but it's time for the truckers to go home. And I turned, I had some people around me when it was aired. I said, aha, you see, I told you, I know exactly how they work. She was trying to bait us. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, Pierre Poilievre on Twitter put out a message saying, I have an announcement I'm going to be making. I'm going to be running for prime minister. And then they stepped on the gas to try to end it.
So you don't believe, because I see a lot of people who are following me, they put a lot of hope in Pierre Poilievre and they think that he is going to be any different. Do you believe he will?
The way the uniparty works right now is the Conservatives do the same thing as the Liberals, but they do it at the speed limit, right? Mm-hmm. So will things get better? Yes, they'll probably get marginally better. Will that be the answer? No. And, you know, I mentioned this in a talk in El Salvador and in Boston, because I got the same sort of question, too. I said, it's not going to be one politician or one election or one political party that's going to save us from the authoritarian creep. It's going to be us changing the culture over time. And the Freedom Convoy was one big step in shifting the culture away from peak wokeness, which is what we were at that point.
So you see a connection between wokeism and the whole crisis that our society is going through right now?
Yeah, I believe identity politics is the cancer that's really fueling a lot of this. And what I'm worried about is the emergence of the woke right, which is something that we're starting to see now.
It exists?
Yeah. You're starting to see the woke right. You know, the same sort of when the Western world has collapsed, it's terrible, it's all corrupt, it's all evil. All we do is carpet bomb the entire world, but Russia's okay, you know?
Yeah,
they're going to two extremes on both sides.
We live in the extremes. It seems that it's impossible to stand, you know, in the middle. And you said earlier in the conversation that you've been trying since the beginning to get, you know, everybody to talk together. It's been also my mission with my podcast. I'm trying to, you know, just reopen the conversation so we are not so divided. I'm very worried with this division. And I don't think that, you know, in history, it's never been a good thing to be so divided. Yeah. So I can't see why it would be a good thing right now. But people are just not, a lot of people are not ready to listen. And, you know, it's been 2 years now. The convoy, I think, is responsible for a lot of mandates that were ended. I do believe in that, even though it was 2 months later in Quebec, it took forever because Quebec was just so ludicrous.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it was really bad here. But, you know, I really do believe that we made a difference, even though they're not going to give us this. But now I get a little frustrated that, you know, everywhere, and you said it earlier, but everywhere, well, in a lot of places in the world, people are starting to realize that we've been lied to, we've been deceived, we've been pointed in a wrong direction, and people are starting to wake up. You know, I don't like to use that word, but it, you know, it's sort of how it feels. But not in Canada. and not in Quebec. And I, and that gets me really, that infuriates me right now, because I'm like, the data is just talking for itself and no one will listen. So what, yes, you say, you know, okay, this was a first step, but how do we get the whole culture to actually change in a positive way?
So there's a couple of things. First, people in Quebec, and I speak to the people in Quebec right now. Sorry, I speak Spanish, but not French.
It's okay.
The news is not real. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you didn't hear that. I know people are going to get upset right now. You got to get this. You got to understand this concept. The news is not real. Very important for people to understand that.
Can I just bring just one tiny nuance? I think there is truth in the news, but it's just flooded in so many lies that it becomes very hard to know what's true and what's not.
The problem with the news is there's so much lies by omission that they're only giving you one side of an argument. Of sometimes there's two or three sides to an argument. Yeah. So if you're only getting one of three, then what you're hearing is not real. Mm-hmm. You need to hear holistically everything that's understanding.
Right.
The other thing is something that we do. I talk about this in Bitcoin often. This was kind of the premise of my speech in El Salvador. We need to stop. Firstly, the data is all corrupt. There's no data that is accurate until you know the presuppositions of how the data was collected. The data can be interpreted any way that you want. And people need to learn to stop trying to persuade people with facts. Yeah. That's what I was doing during the entire convoy. The political class still doesn't understand that, the messaging strategy and how I was doing it. But what I was doing is trying to persuade people. And you persuade people by reaching them emotionally. And once you reach people emotionally, and there's a whole series of different tactics you use for persuasion. You know, social proof is the one that politicians use all the time. That's why they wanted us standing behind them. But reciprocity, there's a whole long list of things. You need to learn to persuade people on the other side just to listen to you. And the best way to do that, and this was the conversation I had with some people from the UK this morning who are on the left, is to explain their position. Just explain that I understand your position. I disagree, but I understand why you think what you do. Now, let me explain to you the other side or the other sides. It doesn't mean you have to agree, but just understand all sides. That's why it's very, like, I spend more of my time watching left-wing news sources or reading left-wing news sources than, you know, on the right, because I don't need confirmation bias. I know what my opinions are. Yeah. I need to know how the other side is thinking and how they're coming to their conclusions. Yeah. And once I understand that, then I know how I can communicate with them. And if we all start doing that over time as a culture, we'll be able to change the culture and just keep things positive. Mm-hmm. Don't attack people. Like, okay, you behaved like Hitler during COVID is not going to get somebody to listen to you, you know?
Not really, yeah. But people get so emotional, and you just said it. That's the problem. We've been controlled by fear, by guilt. So people will react a lot to these emotions because they're not fun to live. So I really, you know, I don't know how. I agree with you. I think it's listening. I think a lot of people struggle to listen to something that is too different from their own perspective.
Well, there's two of the most persuasive emotional states that you get people on. This is how the propaganda works within media and the political class. The primary way to motivate people is under fear. And we've seen that throughout history, throughout authoritarian regimes around the entire world, right? But the counterbalance to that is mockery and humor. That's why I call him Prime Minister Blackface, because it's absolutely funny and ridiculous that moron is running a country, right? And when people can laugh about it, then once we laugh, now we're not in a state of anxiety. Now we don't have our backs up. Now we're going to be a little bit more predisposed to listen to a new idea.
Agreed. Yeah. Well, you're very nuanced. It's refreshing to hear you speak like that. And you seem quite positive. Why are you so optimistic about the future?
I think the future is going to be amazing. I see so much good going on in the world. You know, I talk about this on my live stream. I do whenever I can, a couple of times a week, I do a live stream. And I always try to bring on some sort of white pill of some of the good things that are going on. Mm-hmm. And the last time I did it a few days ago, I said, listen, if you're ever in a state of anxiety, you're reading too much politics, you're starting to get upset, mm-hmm. just go on to YouTube and type in James Webb Telescope. And look at how much we're discovering about the universe, or we've discovered just in the last 2 years. Or look at new technology, or the cyclorotor is going to be the advent of, it sounds crazy, the flying car, but it's taking drone technology and auto technology and this new technology that
like in the fifth element.
Very similar, but okay. They actually have working prototypes. It's crazy. It's wow. Absolutely amazing. So there's so much good that's going on in the world, but yet our political class is focusing all its energy using behavioral economics mm-hmm. to put us into these two silos to get us fighting with each other. Like, remember when, like I said to a friend of mine recently, remember when we used to get together and just go wrench on our cars and just mm-hmm. talk about going to the track on the weekend and stuff, like doing things in life outside of this political noise? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Stephen Hicks, one of my podcasters, said this on, he wrote the book Explaining Postmodernism, which is the underlying philosophy behind all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And he was doing an interview with, I think it was Glenn Beck, if I'm mistaken. Yeah. And he said, I think what we're at is we're just at a state in the human species where we have instant telecommunications around the entire world.
Yeah.
That can be public in the form of social media. And we're still learning how to navigate it and understand who we can trust, who we can't trust. And it's going to take us a generation to develop the filters we need to understand what's true, what's not true, what we should react to emotionally, what we shouldn't react to emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I think he's onto something. It's just we're at a time because that there's a lot of chaos because the political class can manipulate this new tool that we're really not designed to be able to understand. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take a while for us to get wrap our heads around it. That's all.
I had a conversation recently with Naomi Wolf. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
Yeah,
and she was on my podcast two weeks ago, and we got into a pretty intense debate regarding politics because she believes that the only way out of this crisis is through politics, and I really don't believe in politics. I don't believe that anybody who wants to be a politician has good intentions. I think it's very, you know, you have to be a narcissist to want to be in politics. And I do believe there are other ways. I'm not sure how, but I do believe there are other ways to get the whole world to be more unified or more at peace. And I listened to you talk, and I want to ask you, at the end of the day, do you still believe in politics?
Hey, that has been a long conversation. I think this is when the conservatives get upset. I think we are living in a political apparatus that's designed for the 17th century and is not designed for the modern world.
Right.
And that's where the friction comes from. And I think our system needs to evolve to be more representative of a digital world that has instant telecommunications, where it can be used to brainwash and manipulate people, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. What that is, I don't know. I really don't know. And I think we're going to figure it out over time. That's why I'm so positive about the future, because I do see signs of different ideas coming forward. Yeah. And I'm not one of those, you know, just take everything, throw it out, and, you know, we'll just have nothing or rebuild complete anarchy. Yeah. I think it's more nuanced and it takes time. This is why, whether it's, you know, Trump or Milei, who I really love, the reason they're important is because those are the little sledgehammers that come along that will disrupt a little bit, and over the long term, help usher in some change that might solve some of these solutions over time. I think you've got to look at these things generationally. In terms of politics, how it is right now, like I said before, no political party or single politician is going to make the difference. It was Breitbart who accurately said politics is downstream from culture. And I can tell you my frustration with the political apparatus from the inside. I've never seen such cowards in my life. Never. Nobody wants to make a decision everybody who has to make a decision, their response is, well, we should form a subcommittee for that. Mm-hmm. So we're led by cowards and morons. Okay, that's fine. But over time, those cowards and morons, they follow the trajectory of the culture. So that's why during COVID, I didn't care so much about, you know, the political stuff. I cared about reaching people who were close to me in my community, amongst my family and network and stuff like that, try to communicate to them. I'll give you a good example of that. There's a coffee shop I go to fairly regularly near me. I have a weekly meeting with the co-writer of my book, John Goddard, Honking for Freedom. And I was in line one time, and this was right in the height of Crazy Town. I was in line, and I always go in without a mask. My, you know, passive aggressive way of dealing with it was I would never wear a mask until somebody asked me. Then I would put one on, because it's not the fault of the person making minimum wage behind the counter that they have to enforce. And I don't want them to get in trouble, but I'd force them to ask me. Mm-hmm. And you'd be amazed how many times I would never be asked. So
yeah, did you come to Quebec? Anyway, that's another story.
Well, and this is maybe what I'm getting to, because I think Quebec people are strong people. They just, that's
we used to be. We used to be. We've been broken.
Well, there's a lack of leadership. They need a leadership. So what happened was, in this particular case, I always remember it. I ordered my coffee and whatever I had. I went to like the coffee bar at the far end to wait for it. And some woman comes up to me with a mask. And she says to me, "You're not wearing a mask." And as I turned to say about to say something, she said, "No, no, 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 no. I don't want to wear a mask either." I said, "Then take it off." Mm-hmm. I said, I have never worn a mask in this place or many places the entire time of COVID. I said, and you know what I noticed? Every time I go into a place, if I'm in line, I wait about a minute and a half. And people realize I'm not getting harassed. And you know what they do? One by one, they start taking their masks off. And I said, "Look behind you. The person second in line doesn't have a mask on either. Mm-hmm. Just take it off. People need somebody who's going to lead and be willing to stick their neck out, and then they'll follow if it's completely ridiculous," which is what we were dealing with.
We were in a very different paradigm here in Quebec, because I had this attitude at first, because you know, I traveled a lot before the pandemic, the so-called pandemic, and I went a lot, and I traveled a lot in Asia, and they wear masks over there a lot.
Yeah.
So I started doing my research, because I've always been a curious person, and I was, why are they doing this? And I saw that the science didn't really support this, but it was more like cultural. They thought if they had symptoms, they would wear a mask just to, you know, be polite.
Basically. Which has been common in Asia for many years. When you're just sick in general, people wear masks.
Yeah, in Japan and Vietnam and everywhere. So I was familiar with this concept. So, and I was in Asia in March, I was traveling backpacking with my husband. So, and people were starting putting the mask on, and I was like, "I'm not doing this. I don't want to." And I was pregnant, so I didn't want to have this in my face, because I was out of breath all the time. And then we came back to Quebec, and this is where I realized I was like, "I'm not wearing a mask." But everywhere I would go, people would get so incredibly mean with me, and at some point I was anxious just going outside without my mask, because I knew I would get attacked. And then I was like, I don't want to go through this. Like I started wearing the mask just because I didn't want to have to be in a fight with people who were respecting the rules in a way that they felt entitled to tell me to respect the rules as well. So then I listened to your story, and I'm like, were we in the same country? Like I've been trying to do that, but here in Quebec, it was just, I'm not saying it never happened that no one really bothered with me not wearing a mask. But most of the time, I would get violently attacked. I don't know why.
I think there's an element of subconscious psychological framing. If somebody saw me walking into a place, they know I'm going to argue. I'm not doing it. I'm just not doing it. And I don't care what anyone thinks. Like the last thing I care is what strangers think. And maybe that's why.
It's in your vibe.
Yeah, that's why, you know, like maybe that's why I maintained my composure during the convoy and spend so much time telling people, just relax, the sky's not going to fall, we're all here, the sun's going to rise tomorrow, everything will be great, tell me three amazing things that happened to you today, and I do these exercises with them. But I think if you go into that atmosphere where people are anxious and they are predisposed to for conflict with somebody who's not equally anxious, and you're unsure of yourself, then you'll get that. But if you're sure of yourself, they become the ones who are afraid. And I think most people were afraid. Even that woman who came up to me, I could tell she was petrified coming up to me. So what if I had said to her, oh, you're right, I'll put it on. Right.
It would have changed completely the whole vibe.
That's right.
Yeah, you're right. And I guess I was not in the same mood than you were. It was very scary, you know, to see the whole world changing and losing its mind, not being able to think for themselves was very scary when you're still, when you still feel like you think for yourself and you're like, why don't you get to the same conclusions than I do? So, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Tamara. You talked about her. Maybe some people don't know her. You were the two spokesperson. We saw you on the press conferences more than once. She's also a trucker. Am I right?
No.
No, she's not? Okay, so she was involved with, she's the one who got you involved. Yep. Are you still in touch with her? And she went to jail, I think, for, they arrested her for a while. What happened right after the convoy?
Yeah, we don't know. It's really murky what's been going on. That's why I encourage everybody to read Diverge Media, divergemedia.ca. He's been investigating this now for 15 months.
Oh, wow.
I told him some of the, he did an interview with me. And I told him some of the things that were going on behind the scenes. And he said to me, you know, I've heard some of what you've said. I didn't believe you until I started digging. And now that I've interviewed you, I think there's some serious malfeasance that went on there. And I said, yeah. And it was during the convoy. It was very difficult to see. Mm-hmm. I knew something was going on.
Regarding Tamara or the whole organization?
Regarding the organization, just making decisions that were the complete opposite of what would make us successful, that sort of thing, like really weird behavior that was going, but you can't see the full chessboard until afterwards, right? So I knew something was going on, but I didn't know what was going on. I remember on February 19th, the morning we decided, the same morning I told you about when they called me, you have to leave. Mm-hmm. Bridget Belton, who really is one of the people who really started the convoy, first came up with the idea and started reaching out to truckers in November of 2021. She came into my room with all the trucker, the road captains, and Tamara and the other guy were arrested. And so they came to me and said, what do we do? And I said, listen, I'll message whatever you guys want. I don't want to put any of you guys at risk. They had told me a story about a trucker the previous night got raided by the police, guns drawn on him, smashed up his truck, and hauled him off to jail. So I said, look, the government is now getting violent. Right. They realize that they've lost. They're now losing their cool. If you want to leave, then I'll support you. If you don't want to leave, then I'll support you. You just tell me what you want to do. I'm not going to make the decision for you, right? And, you know, they subsequently all decided, you know, like, you know, it's time to leave. And I said, okay, great. But Bridget came in and said, you know, Tamara was a setup. She tried to get arrested. I'm like, what are you talking about? She didn't try to get arrested. Like, okay, fine. I ignore it. Lo and behold, many, many months later, and she put it on her Twitter accounts all over, I see a couple of videos of Tamara Leach and Danny Balfour going up to the police trying to get arrested.
How?
Going up and say, hi, I'm Tamara Leach. Is there a warrant out for me? You can arrest me now.
And they were being filmed?
Yeah.
Wow.
What kind of protester goes up to the government and says, you can now arrest me? And somebody commented somewhere saying, oh, well, she just thought that there was a warrant out for her arrest, so they were just curious. Just curious. Oh. That's called BS because they all had liaison officers. They could have called a liaison officer at any moment and said, is there a warrant out for my arrest? No. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to sleep, right?
Okay, yeah, right. That's the way to do it.
That's right. But you know what? It became a very quick and easy way to end the protest, because that entire week she was not around. Like, she just disappeared, and she would come back. She would message me at like eight or nine in the morning. Sorry, at night. And I'd be like, Hey, where were you? We dealt with a whole bunch of problems. And oh, I was stressed. I had to go to Quebec. Oh, I had to go to the biker church. Oh, I just wanted to go see people. I needed to get away. The stress is getting to me. And I kept telling him, like, that's why we wanted to get you a handler, so you wouldn't be overwhelmed. She's like, no, it's okay. It's fine. And then
she refused the handler.
That's right.
Okay.
And then lo and behold, she shows up that day, comes into my hotel room, like, oh, hey, how you doing? Whatever. Gave her a hug. We took that picture together. And she said, yeah, I'm going to go down to the Ark, whatever. So she goes down to the Ark Hotel, tells him she's going to go spend some time with her husband. And an hour later, I'm in my hotel room. And what pops up on my feed? A video of Tamara crying. And Justin Trudeau has kids too. And I'm like, oh my God, we just spent the past 3 weeks saying all messages vetted through this team. What are you doing? That's the opposite of what you've been telling everybody.
Wait, she was crying for Justin Trudeau?
Well, she's crying for, you know, she's saying that, you know, we have to come together. We can't be so divisive. I look at Justin Trudeau. I have kids. He has kids too. We all have to be. I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I never saw that video. I was not aware that she was so rogue.
It's all over. I think it's still all over Facebook and stuff. And then 45 minutes later or an hour later, she goes out onto the street when the government said nobody come out on the street because we have the EMA, and they go up to the police repeatedly and said, can you arrest us now? And, you know, that's a really good way to end the protest, isn't it?
It did
to
work.
Identify yourself as the leader and then go out, end it, and it just crushes everything, right? And they even, during the POEC, I mean, I knew this because I have a brother who's a police officer and some friends who are cops. So I kind of understood their tactics anyways. Mm-hmm. And it's the same sort of crowd control stuff they do with protests all over. You grab the leaders, mm-hmm. and then you hope the movement fizzles away. But it's not often that the leader goes out and volunteers to get arrested. Like, what?
Yeah, that's so weird. That's so very weird. Disappointing. Honestly, like, I don't understand what would be her motives to do that.
Well, I mean, I don't want to impugn motives. I can suspect a number of things, I mean, there was a lot of pressure that was put on us by the JCCF.
At this moment, your bank account was frozen?
This was just before the bank accounts were frozen.
Okay.
Right. And it's, by the way, not just the bank accounts. Bank accounts, credit cards, corporate accounts, absolutely everything.
You can pay anything.
Nothing. The only
unless
thing
you have cash.
Cash or Bitcoin. Bitcoin's the only thing they couldn't get to, which is why they're upset, right?
We'll get there.
Yeah. So yeah, I think I knew Tamara for 4 years. I didn't realize how many political parties she's been a part of. I know she was part of the 2019 convoy as well. That was also co-opted in the same way. She told me the story, but it turns out she omitted some of the facts and didn't tell me the entire truth, but whatever.
Just like the mainstream media.
Just like the mainstream media. Well, listen, you know, I'm going to give an example of the level of co-opting that I was dealing with behind the scenes. January 30th, we had the first press conference. Okay.
Yeah.
And banned all the legacy media, invited alternative media. So the Post-Millennial was there, Epoch Times, National Telegraph, whatever. We finished. It wasn't a 15-minute press conference. It was 2.5 hours. I wanted everybody to be exhausted. You remember that.
Yeah.
After that press conference, like just as we finished, I got a text message from Alexa. From Rebel News.
From Rebel News, yeah.
Saying, we missed your press conference. We had a miscommunication. Can we do an interview with you? And I said, yeah, sure. And I said, Tamara, don't leave. Alexa's going to come do an interview. She's like, okay, fine. So Alexa came. They must have been running across the downtown because they're out of breath. They come in. They sit us down. I have a picture. I've posted this picture a number of times online. I snapped a picture just as they started. Thank God I did. Because we did 50 minutes, 49 minutes, something like that, a full interview in our full context. And that's why when she said, can we do an interview? I thought, perfect. I can front run legacy media because legacy media was just starting to talk about it. I know all legacy media watches Rebel News, even though they think it's fake. Mm-hmm. And I could get ahead of the narrative. Mm-hmm. That's going to the narrative that's going to say we're racist, bigots, homophobes, whatever they're going to do, because we know that's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
We did almost an hour and Alexa said, okay, I'm going to go translate into French and I'm going to send it in and it'll get uploaded. And I said, okay, great. Go do your thing. I messaged her that night. She said, I'm still working on it. I'm going to work through the night. Great. Next morning, not up. Alexa, what happened? Oh, it's still in process. They're doing something. I sent it in. Okay. That day I got really busy. End of the day, I look, still no interview. They never aired it.
Why?
Now, in context, this was the biggest news story on the planet.
Yeah.
I was getting 10,000 messages and more across all of my platforms. I couldn't keep up with all the things. Bing, 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 everywhere.
Thanks for getting back to me. I really appreciate it.
I did. And I've mentioned you many times, by the way.
Awesome.
And I was getting from all media conglomerates around the world. I gave the exclusive interview to Rebel News.
Yeah, what the hell?
News story of the world. And they haven't, they never uploaded it.
Wait, but why? Did you talk to Alexa afterwards?
No, she doesn't talk to me anymore, like they all do. But I was
so she's controlled opposition. Is that what you're implying?
I hate that term.
I hate that term as well. I really do.
I went to a Jordan Peterson event maybe a year ago now, and the second in charge of Rebel News comes up to me because Rebel News was hosting it. If you notice, they've been hosting all of this stuff and the Democracy Fund, which is also Rebel News, by the way. That's Ezra Levant. The second in charge of Rebel News comes up to me and he says, hey, I knew of his name. I've knew of him, but never met him face to face. And he says, hey, BJ, nice to meet you. I'm like, oh, hey, it's good to meet you. What's up? And he says, listen, just so you know, we heard you mentioned, that interview and, we still have it. We're going to use it in some documentaries and all that sort of stuff. We're going to use the right time or whatever. And I said something like, you know, the right time was when it was the biggest news story in the world, I needed the truth out there. Not now.
I just can't believe it.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Okay. But that annoys me. Like I don't understand why they would do that. So, and you lost 1 hour of your life and you were so busy. So that's so rude. I would be pissed if I were you.
This is the political game. Listen, much of our alternative media is pay for play for the political parties. And it doesn't just happen on the left. It happens on the right as well.
Right. My question is weird, but was Tamara Leach connected to this weird event in any ways? Or?
Well, if you look at Ezra Levant's profile picture, it's a picture of him and Tamara Leach. And she's been doing the fundraising tour with JCCF and the Democracy Fund for 2 years now, while the rest of us have been completely abandoned and had to figure out our own way to fund our legal cases. But
you had $23 million, but you didn't touch one dime of this?
No. Most of it was returned. And the only bit of it that got through was $5 million and change. And that's locked up in escrow pending the class action suit that was launched against us, which is now swelled to a claim of $450 million.
So the government is suing you?
Well, you know how people are in politics is there's always plausible deniability and a layer of cutouts, right? So it's some activists who clearly have ties to the Liberal Party have filed a class action suit because we apparently closed. The claim is something like the distress from the honking.
Oh, yeah, they couldn't
operate their business for 2 weeks. The 2 years prior doesn't matter.
No, exactly. And how ridiculous is that?
Yeah. So it's just lawfare is what it is.
Oh, well, I have a friend who has three restaurants and I was on the phone with him 2 days ago and he just filed bankruptcy for the restaurants because, you know, the pandemic happened and they're all out of business. So I can't believe that they were complaining for 2 weeks when, you know, the whole purpose was to get our life back basically. So
that's right.
Anyway, so yeah, we all know this is BS. Okay, so I want to talk because there's so much. And it's been an hour. I want to talk about Bitcoin. You almost sound like a brand ambassador for Bitcoin. I have a lot of people who are following me who don't believe in Bitcoin at all. They think it's also a way to control us. And others, just like me, and I'm really happy that Bitcoin is up because I made the mistake to buy 4 years ago when it was already very high. Yeah. So I'm happy it's back on, you know, a good place. Can you explain why do you think Bitcoin is a solution for the future?
Because that hyperbolic example that Bitcoiners always talk about, how if you have an authoritarian government that tries to crush you, Bitcoin is the only thing that will work. That actually occurred, but it didn't occur in Iran or Pakistan or other authoritarian regimes. It happened in Canada when we were all locked out. I mean, we had one of the truckers was crying when the bank accounts were locked because she said, I need to buy insulin in 2 weeks. What am I supposed to do? Just die? I'm supposed to allow my diabetes to kill me? Wow. Of all the donations that were raised, cumulatively just under $24 million, all of it was locked up in the in escrow and is currently in escrow. However, $850 million was distributed directly to truckers. It's the only money the government couldn't stop. Mm-hmm. Now, they ended up eventually seizing, I think it was 5 Bitcoin or something like that, that's remaining.
Which is a lot.
Yeah, it's a couple $100,000. And the reason is because Caribou, a Bitcoiner, who was the one, I mean, I couldn't run around, I had a broken ankle. So he was the one running around printing the paper wallets and distributing the Bitcoin to the truckers, who some of them just broke down in tears because they were at their wit's end. They didn't have, they saw bankruptcy looming sort of thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a couple of them really did. But the only way that the government got the remaining Bitcoin that he was not able to distribute yet is because they sent 15 officers from the RCMP and the OPP to raid his house with a warrant to steal his computer and his cell phones, his podcast mic, his personal diary, and a bunch of stuff. That's the only way you can get Bitcoin. And if it was just in a seed phrase that was in his head that he didn't write down, they'd never be able to get it. That's just the nature of what Bitcoin is. Mm-hmm. So if you don't like Justin Trudeau and you don't like authoritarianism, then perhaps a distributed what I call the freedom protocol, because it's just a protocol, a distributed ledger that doesn't have a single central point of failure that the government can't control, that might be a good hedge against authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm. And do you use your Bitcoin? Like, do you think it's accessible in that way right now in 2024?
So I've used Bitcoin. When I did my book, I hired a team of Venezuelans who live in Panama.
Because you were in Panama when you wrote your book, right?
No. I was all over. I was here. I was traveling, okay. Whatever. But I paid for this book to get produced after I wrote everything. I paid them in Bitcoin. And the reason was because they're in Panama. And once, you know, we agreed to work together because they sent me a quote, I said, how do you want me to pay you? And they said, Ellie said, oh, yeah, you're Canadian. I don't want Canadian dollars. I live in Panama. I said, well, why don't I just pay you in Bitcoin? And you said, oh, yeah, I think I have a Bitcoin wallet. Yeah, sure. Here's my address. And so I paid, and he said to me, you know what? You just made my life, my business so much easier because most of the clients are all over the world. Mm. He said, I'm now invoicing everything in US dollars and Bitcoin to give people the option just because it's easier in terms of, you know, transacting around the world.
But it's so volatile. So how do you manage to agree on a quote if the Bitcoin keeps just changing?
Is the Bitcoin volatile or is the dollar volatile?
You tell me, you're the pro. Well, I would assume all of this, but the Bitcoin has been very, very low in the past 2 years, 3-4 years.
So I know people who, I started telling people to get Bitcoin at $800. I know somebody who started mining Bitcoin at 9 cents. And
he
was
so rich.
He was very, very wealthy before that. So if you bought Bitcoin at 9 cents and 15 years later, it's worth $80,000 Canadian, is that a good store of value?
It is.
So I talk about this frequently on the radio. I go on a radio show. I might do a segment later today. Mark Petroni on AM 916 in Toronto. And, you know, I finally orange pilled him and got him into Bitcoin and told him it's not a stock. It's not something, it's not a regular ETF. It's a new type of financial instrument we've never had before.
Yeah.
We've never had money that is deflationary. It's never existed. Mm-hmm. Gold was the closest thing we got to. Said you have to train yourself out of the day to day. Like, I didn't know about the price of Bitcoin until yesterday. Somebody told me. I thought it was at like 40,000. You got to get out of the day-to-day thing and look at things over a period of a couple of years.
Yeah.
When in doubt, zoom out. And when you look at and you see that chart from 9 cents to 80,000,
it's just going up.
What has the Canadian dollar done in the same time? How much purchasing power have you lost since COVID?
That's insane. Yeah. So there's there's a lot of hope, and eventually I'm going to do a whole podcast on cryptocurrency because there's so much to understand for those who are newbies to this. And I don't want to hold you more. We've been together for an hour, and I really appreciate it was very interesting because we never had the time to do a sort of a post-mortem of what really happened. Thanks for being who you are. You've been so important in so many people's lives. And I know you will be humble and that's perfect, but someone had to take the role of being the spokesperson, and it was very important. So thank you.
I'll tell you the number one thing I learned in all of this. I never realized the power of this, that in messaging to people around the world, which is what I was trying to do, just about love and peace and being kind to each other, I never realized what an appetite people have for that sort of positivity in their lives. Mm-hmm. And what a difference that made on just keeping things as positive as possible. That's why we had the three saunas, the hot tub, the dance parties, the barbecues. It's because we built it all on the essence of love and hope.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had politicians who understood that, mm-hmm. the world would be a lot better place. But you know what? That's why we'll change the culture and make the culture that way. And they'll have to reflect it.
One podcast at a time. We're going to change the culture. People can follow you, I think, on X. You're pretty active on X. Can you tell, just for those who want to follow you, where can we find you?
So on Twitter, X is at BJ Dichter, which is my initials and last name. Or you can just go to BenjaminJDichter.com. And that goes to a link tree that has all my links.
Perfect. Well, thanks so much for your time. And we'll be in touch. And for those who want to purchase your book, I assume they can. Is it a PDF or can we get a hard copy?
No, look here. It's a real book. I got a bunch of them.
So we can order a copy.
Just go to honkingforfreedom.com.
Honkingforfreedom.com. Thank you, BJ. Have a good one.
Cool. Thank you.
Bye.